You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Mildred Beltre. She's talking to me from Brooklyn. Mildred, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you.
Mildred, tell me a little bit about what you're working on now. I'm sure it's in your studio and otherwise, but what are you involved with at the moment?
So I guess I'll start with the studio. In the studio, I'm working on some drawings and prints. The drawings I'm working on are mostly text-based abstractions in that the text isn't immediately visible. They sort of employ they use the language of, I guess, cross-stitch, you know, the visual language of cross-stitch or quilt making or other kind of craftings too. So they're very colorful, and then the text is sort of embedded in the image. And so you can sort of take it in as like this field of color and then.
But these are woven. Are we talking about prints or kind of weaving?
These are the drawings, actually. So the materials for, so the things I'm describing now are the drawings, and the materials for the drawings, for the most part, are walnut ink and colored pencil. They're really labor intensive. So I recently was thinking that maybe I could make them with gouache or some other kind of paint. The problem, however, is that I'm not a painter and I don't paint, and so it's not necessarily faster. But it's interesting to see, you know, what can happen if I sort of switch the materials a little bit. So I'm working on sort of switching the materials, but I think I do like the color pencils in there, so I might keep that.
But you don't
in
see yourself
and definitely
as a painter,
the walnut ink.
So you feel like you can't go into that area. I mean, it's interesting that you said you don't see yourself as a painter. This
I know. Well, it's so funny. I mean, it's. Yeah, it seems like it shouldn't be that hard, but it's just the liquid versus the solid. It seems really silly, but...
Well, it's a very different approach, you mean. It's a different approach. You could
yeah.
think, but you like the use of materials or the control of the materials you have.
Yes.
So those are the drawings, and that's one series you're working on, drawings?
So that's one series. Another series is also... walnut ink based in material, but the image is very different. These are sort of figurative. They're mostly self-portraits. But the visual strategy is similar in that the image isn't immediately legible. So, you know, again, they look really different from the text-based drawings, but conceptually I think they're tied in that there's just like a legibility issue. And so the way that the figures work is that they're actually more easily read from far away. And then as you come closer to it, the image disappears a little bit. And with that, I just wanted to, I guess, have viewers think about, you know, what it is that they think they see and then what happens when you're up close, right? So like if you take that in an interpersonal way, sort of like the understanding of a person or a group from a distance versus what happens when you come up close to that thing or that person, you know, your understanding might have to shift or changes or is completely, you know, not there, right? What you thought you knew isn't actually there.
Right. Well, it's interesting. And are these things, do you think, still influenced by, I know you have a background in printmaking, right? You went to school for printmaking?
I did, yes. Yeah. So the text-based pieces are primarily drawing now, although I have made prints. In that way, the figure-based works are have a hand-painted layer with the walnut ink. Somehow walnut ink I'm fine with, but as soon as I call it paint, it's different. But the figurative images on there with digital printing. And the language that it employs is sort of the language of the dot. So it is, it's very related to sort of printmaking and, you know, silk screens, which I also make a lot of.
And so, okay. So that's one body of work. And then,
yes. And
is there also an ongoing series, the slogans for the revolution that never was, is that still ongoing?
It is also. So, last summer I had a show at the Everson Museum, which is in Syracuse, New York, and I wanted to experiment.
It's a great museum.
Scale.
Congratulations on that show. That's pretty exciting. To
Thank
show
you
that.
So much. Yeah, the space was really
gorgeous. Right, it's amazing.
Yeah. And so I wanted to experiment. It was an opportunity to really try some larger scale pieces. And so I had I designed and made these larger sort of textile pieces that I guess combined the text with the figurative images into these sort of machine woven tapestries. And the idea behind the slogan, for a long time I was involved in a lot of political organizations sort of that we're interested in, and we're just in developing sort of like horizontalist, you know, non-hierarchical practices. And so it's something that I've thought about for a long time, and I've tried to think about how to bring it to my work in a lot of different ways.
What does that mean? Is that horizontal, non-hierarchical practice?
So meaning that, you know, if you look around our world, right, most of our world is based on hierarchies. So, for instance, if you go to a job, there's a boss, and that boss has more say over anything than, you know, the assistant manager. And then the assistant manager has more say over things than the people who whatever do whatever the work is. And so that there's a sort of top-down approach. So in horizontalist practices, it's about a delegation or a division of work that isn't about, valuing, not prioritizing one opinion more than the other, so that, you know, things are made more through a discussion and consensus, I guess, to put it in really simple ways, right? But it's more on a consensus-based approach rather than a hierarchical, like someone says something, you have to do it.
So how would you apply that
power over you?
Or is that more about the content of it?
It's more about the content. So this is just a long way of saying that, you know, so through that engagement over many, many years, I've just had a lot of time to reflect on those practices. And I decided that I wanted to make a series of tapestries based on jokes. And these jokes were jokes that were sort of like jokes that I thought people in these communities would understand, and pretty much only these communities. So for instance, one of the jokes is horizontalist, or one of the slogans is horizontalist, do it on the ground, are you down? And the reason that that has any meaning whatsoever is because, you know, horizontalism or horizontalist practices, horizontalism is actually, you know, a title that comes from a book about around this work that was being done in Argentina, right? So horizontalism and horizontalist practices were something developed through sort of a popular education practices. And people can look these words up.
You're kind of combining that with high and low. There's also there's humor in there.
Yeah,
that's kind of wonderful as well.
Right? Come up with these, with these sort of silly jokes that incorporated these ideas in them. So that was one of them. And another slogan was social justice is sexy, so fuck capitalism. And the third joke was the revolution won't come until you're all in.
Let me ask one more thing about the slogans then, because that's fascinating, and they seem to go through so many iterations, and, you know, as you were talking about social justice and capitalism, tell me about the one where it says there is no black in a rainbow. That doesn't seem so, it seems like it could be funny in this context, but it's not funny.
Right. So just to back up a little bit, so my use of text, I guess, comes from a few different sources. So sometimes the text is borrowed. So, for instance, in that case, the There's No Black in a Rainbow is a borrowed text. And then others, like in the tapestries, are things that I made up. So, like the jokes, for instance, are text that I generate. So to talk about the There's No Black in a Rainbow, that quote, and I actually can't remember who said it. I'll see if I can remember throughout the conversation, but that came from, so that was a phrase that came after some of the work that had been done in South Africa around truth and reconciliation, where there was this idea put forward about a rainbow nation. And then the phrase, there's no black in the rainbow, was put forward as a critique of that and saying that it was sort of this this ornamental kind of statement, and that it was sort of like, it was pretending that there was actual integration happening, but that, you know, like even in the conceptualizing it of a rainbow, there was an omission, you know, so that even the terms were wrong. And so I borrowed that phrase because I thought it was funny, but then also, of course, very poignant, right? So that it's this sort of like myth, it's like a missed opportunity, or like not thinking about how the language that's being used around a problem is itself creating a problem, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I was using it as something that I thought was funny, but it obviously, you know, has implications. It's also interesting with that because I think people interpret that statement in different ways. I'm curious how you interpreted it.
How I interpret it? I interpret it as a kind of a consciousness-raising slogan, you know, almost like a Black Lives Matter, you know. Did you ever notice there was no black in the rainbow, which, you know, that's how I interpreted it, as having something to do with that.
Yeah, no, and it's that. So it's just about, you know, exclusion within inclusion, in a way. Mm-hmm. And then also, I guess as an aside, there's also this interesting, I guess it was Jim Dine, I remember, I saw it at the Brooklyn Museum, made this drawing, and it was called Black Rainbow, and he had made a drawing for CORE. And it was a black rainbow, and so I thought, like, oh, like, this is an interesting idea, right? Like, the idea of whether or not black is part of a rainbow, or, like, what it means to integrate black in the rainbow. So in that piece that has that phrase, that's an embroidery piece, or cross-stitch piece, rather, and, you know, I sort of attempt to start to bring the black into the rainbow. So the rainbow, it's embroidered in rainbow colors, and then I sort of start to bring the black up into it, but it doesn't quite touch.
Right, and you know, so you don't see it. I mean, I did interpret it more as almost an activist statement. You know, as the kind of series implies, like a revolution that isn't just tongue in cheek, but relates to what's happening now, a reflection of what's going on at the moment, or as you're talking about inclusion and exclusion within inclusion, whatever you just said, but that's part of our social fabric now that we're struggling with.
Right. No, exactly. And so I guess with the slogans for The Revolution Never Was, I am trying to use, you know, humor, sexiness, seriousness to sort of get at, you know, what is it that these revolutionary practices look like in our daily life? You know, what does it look like in a more day-to-day, or how does it affect us in ways that are sort of surprising or funny, or, you know,
right,
not the places where we're looking for them.
And I want to talk about one of the projects of yours, but is there something else you want to mention about an upcoming show? I mean, it's very exciting that you had a show at the Everson. Are there other shows coming up, or anything we should mention before I talk about that one more project of yours, the Brooklyn High Art Machine?
Sure, yeah. I have the next, I guess, exhibition I have is a solo exhibition that I'm developing for the Kentler Art Center, Drawing Center, for the Kentler Drawing Center in Red Hook, New York. And so for that, I think I'll be developing more work around the slogan and creating more text-based pieces for that. So I'm excited for that. And that'll be in June 2019.
And let me ask you this before we talk about your community-based work. As an artist, your career seems to be really growing, right? You're having these great shows in a lot of different places. And it's not easy to get shows, and your work, you know, in many ways is complex. How did you begin getting shows? How did you begin to get out into the world as an artist? Because you seem to have a lot of momentum now.
Well, thank you. I wish I had. Let's see, what is the answer? I think one thing. Well, maybe this is a good segue into my group project, and maybe it'll tie into the question that you're asking. So another aspect, really important aspect of my work, is a collaborative project that I developed with my neighbor and fellow artist, Oasa DuVernay. And she, what we did was, we sort of found ourselves living in the same building here in Crown Heights, Brooklyn. And we were both teaching artists. We were both mothers. We were both Native New Yorkers. We were both of Caribbean descent. And we sort of started doing drawing together. You know, we sort of realized at one point we were both artists. We're like, oh, come over and draw. And then we'd go over and we would have conversations. And through that, we would have discussions about things and, you know, thought, oh, this is nice. And then we wondered what would happen if we sort of brought that outside. Like, what would happen if we brought this sort of art-making activity outdoors and would it allow us to have these sort of conversations or more intimate encounters with people that we didn't know very well. And so we sort of brought out a table and a tent and some art supplies and invited people to make art with us. And so that was
But this
the
is also about the neighborhood too, right? Because I mean, describe that a little more, because you brought that outside, but you're in a neighborhood with apartment buildings. No, I'm still here.
Sorry, I didn't hear your question.
I'm still here. So what you're saying is to just talk a little bit about the neighborhood itself that you're bringing these supplies out into.
Yes.
It's a neighborhood of apartment buildings or houses, because that's also the type of environment.
Sure. Yeah, so like I said, it's Crown Heights, Brooklyn. Crown Heights, Brooklyn has for, I don't know, maybe the last 30 years been, or maybe 40, I'm not sure, been a predominantly West Indian and African American neighborhood, which is now going through like a deep and violent gentrification process. You know, so gentrification isn't just about people moving in who formerly hadn't lived there. It also comes along with a lot of extra policing and a lot of harassment and a lot of people being evicted from their apartments. You know, so it's a violent process. It's a more violent process than people consider. You know, and I just think it's about people complaining about, you know, strangers moving in, but it's not that so much. It's really about all the policing and harassment that happens for older residents in the neighborhood, and also that the streets get policed and are made safer for those new people, while the presence of those older residents on the street becomes criminalized. So part of what the Brooklyn Hyatt Machine wanted to do was reclaim space on the street where we could just be and make work and be like, have it be a creative and generous space for the adults and the kids on the block. So for the past 7 years, we come out in the summer months and we do different art projects with anybody coming by, really. Anybody.
So this isn't funded by anyone else. This is just you and your collaborator bringing this out, kind of creating a public project on your own without any funding, right?
Well, that's how we started. So it's had different iterations. So at different times, we've been funded through, there's an organization called Citizens Committee that organizes community-based projects. We've also received art grants. We received a grant from the Brooklyn Arts Council. So we've been funded both through sort of non-art entities as well as some art entities. But most of the time, we just figure out how we can do it. So if we have funding, we'll do it one way. We'll do it grander. If we don't have funding, which has happened many times, then we just do it smaller scale.
And the smaller scale is you're bringing art supplies out onto the street on tables?
On tables, mm-hmm. And we always have snacks as well, because we found that a really good way to bring people out and draw them to you is to offer them a little snack. So that's always a good way to get people.
That's great. What kind of snack? Do you mind me asking?
Again, it depends on the year. So, you know, when we're like, when we have some funding, we'll do barbecues and we'll have like chicken and
salad. Well, that's a pretty serious snack. That sounds like
yeah,
like a
that's
picnic.
Like a nice snack. And then when we
But that's so important. That's really interesting, the element of snacks, of food, right, to draw a crowd as opposed to artists doing, you know, an intervention and kind of thing, you know what
right.
I mean? Or even volunteer thing. Food is universal.
Yeah. No, it's a good draw. I mean, and it's also, you know, it's been a trick used by community organizers forever. So it's, you know, it's tried and true. I recommend it. And then the other thing that's been an important part of the Brooklyn High Art Machine has also been fence weaving. So our block has an overpass where there's a chain link fence. And I guess a year, for about the last 6 years, we've been weaving into that fence. And we just weave different text messages into the fence. And so that's also been a really nice way to have conversations with people and to start conversations with people about different subjects. So the text, so for instance, this year's or last summer's weaving, which is about to come down, read friend where I end, you begin. And so it's been nice, you know, if I sit on the stoop, I can sort of watch people walk by the weaving and sort of stop and take it in and sometimes I'll see people talk to each other about it. More often than not, you know, people are taking pictures in front of it. But it's a nice way to sort of start conversations with people. And then also when we're out here working, you know, people often stop and they're like, oh, my God, oh, that's you. That's so nice. Thank you so much. And they also, in the beginning, used to ask, like, oh, what organization are you from? And we would say, oh, we're not from an organization. Like, we live right there. We could just point to the building where we live, which is, like, you know, just across the street from where we're doing the project. And I think it really changes the dynamic. I think communities of color are used to having people come in from the outside doing projects
right. But
it's a really different thing when, you know, you have to sustain that relationship over many years. And it's also interesting doing public art project where you live because whatever the fallout from the project is, whether it's good or bad, we have to live with the consequences and we have to hear about
it
and deal with it, you know, so we don't get to walk away from the work that we're making. We have to live with it. And we also have to be responsible to the others who live with it as well.
Right. Very interesting. And this was also, so that continues, and this was also somehow a segue into how you began also getting more exhibits and wonderful shows like the Everson.
So I would guess, like, one thing that's important is thinking about how do you create your own opportunities. And so that the Brooklyn High Art Machine, in a way, was, you know, a waste and I thinking about, you know, how do we create opportunities both for our work, you know, for sharing our work in a way that felt meaningful to us. And, you know, and then also how do you balance the idea of where do you want to share your work with showing, during the gallery system. So I feel like I've been fortunate, you know, in that I've had a few people who have taken interest in my work and invited me in shows, and I feel like that's a lot of how, I mean, I would imagine that's what it is for a lot of people, you know. Someone takes an interest in your work and they invite you to do things, and then that creates a momentum. But I guess the other thing is I just apply for a lot of things now. You know, so that there is this, that you can't be passive in.
You mean applying for group shows and grants and things like that?
Applying for group shows and grants, you know, and then also the Brooklyn High Art. It's interesting. It started as a street project, but then it started to get attention from institutions. And so as it did that, we also had to think about whether or not it was appropriate for the Brooklyn High Art Machine project to enter into institutions and what it would mean for those projects to do that. So, you know, we had a couple of bad experiences with institutions.
The community projects, besides creating opportunities, also, as you're saying, got institutional attention, and that also brought you into the fold of the institution as an artist and a community organizer or
yeah.
event maker.
Yeah. But then there's also, I think one needs to be cautious about how you bring a community-based project into the institution and whether or not it's appropriate.
Right.
And so, you know, some of the ways in which we've dealt with that has been to develop specific projects that need to address the audience of an institution better than the projects that we do on the street. You know, I mean, the one thing that the Brooklyn Hat Machine is invested in is like a particular audience, and that audience
right.
isn't necessarily present in the institution. So the one time we got invited to do a project, the Brooklyn Hat Machine got invited to do a project with an institution, and so we developed a project that was just for them rather than trying to bring what we did in the street into an institution. So we developed a project called Gentrifiers Anonymous, which was meeting where people could come and talk about their participation in gentrification. The idea being that people recognize gentrification, but it's always out there. You know, it's something that's happening. And
right.
Gentrifiers Anonymous gave everyone an opportunity to sort of hold it close and to talk about it, you know, from the inside out rather than the outside only. If that makes
right.
sense.
It does make sense, and that's very exciting. So that will continue to go on. Are you having any iterations of that in a museum upcoming?
I think we're actually going to, we were recently invited to speak to a class at one of the institutions here in New York City, one of the universities. And so we were thinking we would do, and it's actually an artist, an entrepreneur class. And we were invited to speak, and it seemed maybe appropriate to try to do a Gentrifiers Anonymous meeting with them, you know, since often art is used so much as a tool of gentrification, and artists sometimes unwittingly, you know, can be agents for that without knowing, because we are just looking for opportunities. You know, sometimes the work we do can be used to further those kinds of projects, and we don't always realize it. So it seemed like it would be good to sort of have that conversation with people who are interested in the arts but are also interested in entrepreneurship, and see what kind of intervention can happen there.
That sounds exciting. And let me ask you one last question. What are you reading now? It's the question I ask everybody at the end. I'm always just curious what you're reading.
Okay. So I guess what I'm reading right now is I just got the new Fred Norton book, Black and Blur. And I'm not too far into it so far. I'm still in the first chapter because his writing, I don't know if you know it, it's so dense, but it's so poetic. And so I'm working my way through that. And I can talk about two sort of interesting ideas that he's put forward so far that I'm sort of considering and thinking what I can do with is, he's talking about, Cedric Robinson, who wrote Black Marxism, and in the way he describes, he has this way that Fred Norton has this way that he repeats phrases over and over in what he's writing, and I think that's where the poetic part, you know, comes in, is that, and he always uses the phrase, he talks about how someone is interested and implicated in something, and then he'll go on to name the idea, and then he'll say it again. They're interested and implicated in, and I really like that. I really am sitting with that idea of, you know, how it is that one speaks about things, and people often say, like, I'm interested in this, and again, it's that thing, it's like it's outside you, but to say that you're interested and implicated in something, you know, what does that then open up for how you can look at it, think about it, talk about it, so I think that's a really beautiful idea.
I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure talking about your work and activities.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.